a sandworm. Paul went out into the desert, set out a thumper to attract the sandworm, and waited alone on a dune. Soon, he heard the roar of the approaching worm. He stood frozen, holding a maker hook in his hands, and waited. Suddenly, with a deafening noise, the worm burst up out of the sand. It was huge, over 100 feet tall. Thousands of teeth glistened in the 80-foot circle of its mouth. Paul ran beside the sandworm and quickly hooked himself on its writhing, bucking body. The worm turned its body upward to keep the sand from hurting its exposed flesh. Then, in one swift motion, Paul planted more hooks in its breathing holes.
I've conquered it! Now I'm a sand rider!
He yelled proudly. Months became years. The sands on the planet Dune shifted in the wind. Paul grew into manhood as the Fremen's fearless leader. He continued leading his troops in raids on the Harkonnen spice mining operations. The Harkonnen losses of spice and equipment were piling up, and the Baron's nephew feared he could no longer hide them from his uncle. He screamed with rage.
I will find this Mordib and suck the blood from him!
Millions of light years away, on the far side of the galaxy, Emperor Shaddam IV paced nervously in his golden room. The reason for his nervousness suddenly appeared before him. It was a first-stage navigator who had not yet changed into a third-stage navigator. The first-stage navigator's raspy voice filled the air.
Emperor Shaddam, you have failed miserably. This Paul Muad'Dib, whoever he is, still lives. The spices of Dune are in danger from his Fremen armies, and you and that bungling Baron Harkonnen are responsible. You must remedy this situation.
Muad'Dib is clever, but I will mount a full-scale attack,
promised the Emperor.
I will activate every legion I have and send them to Dune immediately. I will attack and destroy the Fremen rabble, and this new leader of theirs as well.
Paul knew that if he was to help the Fremen in their final battle against the Harkonnen and the Emperor, he would need great wisdom. He would need to see the future. The only way he could do that was by drinking the mysterious, all-powerful Water of Life. Chani, who had fallen in love with Paul, begged him not to.
Please, Paul, the water could kill you, for no man who has taken it has lived.
I have no choice, my love. It is my destiny.
So Chani went with Paul and his Fremen warriors out into the desert. There, he drank the Water of Life. Paul screamed as a thousand horrors filled his mind. But he finally awakened from his nightmare, having seen the future. Returning to the Fremen, Paul announced,
"The time of the final battle has come. I know a secret our enemies do not. I know how to destroy all spice forever, and I can now fold space as well. Now our enemies will fear me. Our time has come."
Paul and his Fremen warrior aides stood at the top of Arise, studying the Arrakeen Palace and its defenses. They had been watching for days now and waiting. They had watched as the Emperor's forces landed and watched as his steel tent extended down below his own ship, serving as his palace and protective cover.
"Now is the time to begin,"
Paul said evenly, studying the sky.
"The sandstorm is developing as planned, larger and more fierce than anything ever known before. And what about the sandworms?"
"They are on their way, Muad'Dib,"
a Fremen responded.
"We have put out thousands of thumpers to attract them. Just listen."
It was true. Their thumping roared across the desert like thunder.
"This will be a gathering of worms the likes of which no one has ever seen before,"
Paul exclaimed. And so it was. The desert sand rose like ocean waves as hundreds of worms approached. Waiting to ride them, hooks ready, were the Fremen warriors. Meanwhile, at the Arakeen Palace, Baron Harkonnen was ordered to rush to Shaddam's tent. The Emperor was angry.
Your mistakes forced me to come here. Your cruel treatment of the people on Dune has caused a rebellion among the Fremen.
At that moment, a small girl in long black robes entered. It was Alia, Paul's sister. Alia announced,
I am the messenger from Muad'Dib, Paul Muad'Dib, who is really Paul Atreides.
Before the Emperor and the Baron could get over their shock, loud explosions were heard outside the tent. Paul and the Fremen had begun their attack. Enraged, the Baron grabbed for Alia, but she jabbed a poisoned needle into his face, crying,
Here is the revenge of the Atreides family!
The Baron gasped and died as another huge explosion burst open the steel wall of the Emperor's tent. Harkonnen's fat body, which was floating in midair, was sucked out of the hole in the wall, only to be swallowed by one of the attacking sandworms.
They have broken through the outer shield wall!
Shaddam shouted in panic.
I am under attack!
Quickly, Your Majesty! Into your ship for safety!
Yelled the captain of his personal guard. Alia laughed as she ducked out, escaping into the confusion of the battle raging around the Arakeen Palace. Thousands of explosions illuminated the sandstorm as it swirled over everything. And out of the darkness came the Fremen sand riders, hundreds mounted on each worm. The sandworms and their riders poured through the broken shield wall and scattered the terrified legions of the Emperor. Most of the troops were either swallowed or crushed by the sandworms, and those that were left met their fate at the hands of the Fremen warriors. When the victorious Fremen entered Arakeen Palace, Paul ordered his prisoners brought before him. Paul leveled his gaze at the defeated Emperor.
I have true power now, he said. I can destroy all the spice which gave you and the Bene Gesserit your special powers.
How dare you speak to me that way?
Retorted the Emperor. Then turning to Fade, the Baron's evil nephew, Shaddam said,
Here, Fade, take my knife and fight this Paul Atreides.
Fade took the Emperor's knife and stepped forward, opposite Paul. The two began to circle each other, each looking for a weakness in the other. Soon, they were rolling on the floor, grappling, each with a knife seeking the other's throat. Suddenly, Fade shifted his body and lifted his leg.
Muad'Dib!
Chani screamed.
He has a poison dart hidden on his leg.
Just as the dart was about to plunge into Paul, he flung his body to one side and, in the same movement, his own knife found Fade's throat. Paul rose to his feet, triumphant. Throwing down his knife, he announced,
I no longer need a knife or a weirding module, for I now can kill with a word.
The Fremen chanted,
Oh, Muad'Dib, you are truly the leader our legend promised us.
Shani exclaimed. Paul's blue eyes shone. There would be justice and peace in the known universe at last. Suddenly, a downpour of rain, life-giving, life-sustaining rain, began to fall on Dune. And gathered outside the palace walls, jubilant Fremen raised their voices as one, in triumph.
After Dune Part 2, we heard Jihad Begins, Last Fight. And in the background is Paul Chooz's finale from Graham Revel's score for Frank Herbert's Dune. Next week, the Voice of Science Fiction will be live starting at 11:15 p.m. as the Destiny's Film Review Fremen ride in to discuss Dune Part 2. On March 15th and 22nd, we'll take you to last summer's Icon in the Park for the Icon Writers' Reunion featuring Keith R.A. DeCandido, Patrick Thomas, Drew Henriksen, and Roy Morrison. As Destiny's 40s continue, listen for a review of Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, a new letter to Dear Cthulhu, more poems by Christina M. Rao, a memorial for Tracy Torme, Destiny's radio theater performances of Battle for the Planet of the Apes, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Gremlins and the Last Starfighter, interviews with Robin Esterhammer, Devo Spice, Athena Kamen, Jim Shooter, Zia Adams, Sam J. Jones, Robin Curtis, and Lance Henriksen. Mark Gunn at the Icon 31 Cabaret, panels and concerts from Icon, Eternal Con, El Icon, and El I Who, and Destiny's 41st Anniversary Special. To offer your comments about our program or to request copies of this or any previous broadcasts, you can write to Destiny's, care of WUSB Radio, 2nd Floor West Side Dining, Stony Brook University, Stony Brook, New York, 11794. You can also send email to destiniesvoice@aol.com, that's destiniesvoice@aol.com, or tweet us at Destiny's. Or you can call me at 631-632-6901. That's 631-632-6901 right after tonight's show. Destinies is produced by members and friends of the Science Fiction Forum in association with WUSB Stony Brook. The forum is located in rooms LO608 and LO609 in the Stony Brook Student Union. For information about forum activities, log on to sf4m.org. That's sf4m.org. To hear archived Destiny shows, including our September 29th, 2000 episode featuring Wonder Woman in Amazons from Space, visit www.captphilonline.com. That's CaptPhilonline.com. While you're online, learn about the life and work of Christina at ChristinaMRau.com. That's ChristinaMRau.com. Listen for 3 hours of encore broadcasts and music, featuring interviews with Patrick Thomas on the Destiny's Archives mini-marathon, Thursday, March 7th from 3 to 6 a.m. here on WUSB. Tonight's show is dedicated to the memory of artist Ramona Fraiden, who died on February 24th at the age of 97. Enjoying a remarkable 74-year career as a comics artist, she was best known for her 10-year run illustrating the Aquaman strip in Adventure Comics, as well as her co-creation of Metamorpho. Some of her other well-remembered work for DC Comics included Freedom Fighters, Super Friends, Plastic Man, and stories in House of Mystery and House of Secrets. In addition, she drew the Brenda Starr Reporter newspaper strip from 1980 to 1995. Her final DC works will appear in March on Women's History Month variant covers for Wonder Woman No. 7, Catwoman No. 63, and Power Girl No. 7. Until next Friday at 11:15 p.m. when we'll be live to review Dune Part 2. For Christina M. Rau, this is Howard Margolin reminding you to stay tuned for Threat Level Midnight coming up next and wishing you the best of all possible destinies. Good evening and welcome to Destinies. I'm Howard Mark Olin.
I'm Audrey Detmering.
Justin Paul.
Dave Campfield.
And tonight, the voice of science fiction is coming to you live as the Destinies film review Fremen ride in to discuss Dune Part 2. The second half of the saga has grossed over $211 million since opening last Friday, already exceeding its production budget and becoming the first major hit of 2024. But does it flow like the spice, or has this story been doomed to death? We'll consider that and more over the next half hour, but first, here's our own Reverend Mother when it comes to Dune, Audrey Detmering, with a brief synopsis of the plot.
Dune Part 2 picks up minutes after Dune Part 1 ends, with Paul and Jessica as fugitives from the Emperor, the Imperium, and the Harkonnen Massacre of House Atreides, with their most loyal friends and retainers either dead or lost to them, alone in the deep desert of Arrakis with only their Fremkits, their wits, and the water contained in their bodies, at the mercy of a band of Fremen, one of whom Paul has just killed in a duel to the death, thus winning the Fremen leader Stilgar's acceptance and protection. Dune Part 1 was the story of protected and privileged ducal heir Paul Atreides of Arrakis. Dune Part 2 is the story of Paul Muad'Dib, the Kwisak Haderach, the Lysan al-Gaib of Siege Tabra and Dune.
In the nearly 40 years I've been with Destinies, this is the third time Dune has been adapted for film or television with varying results. I would say the third time's the charm, as Denis Villeneuve has delivered a version that has more time to breathe than David Lynch's hurried 1984 effort, and production design and effects that brings the viewer fully into the world of the film, especially in IMAX, unlike the comparatively low-budget version seen on the Sci-Fi Channel in 2000. This film spends 2 hours and 46 minutes fleshing out the part of the novel that David Lynch's movie covered in 40 minutes. So naturally, we get much more insight into Paul's development into the Mahdi, the prophesied messiah of the Fremen, and get a deeper look at the relationship between Paul and Chani. We even learn more about Princess Irulan and her role as a Bene Gesserit instead of just a monotone narrator. The dialogue is presented in a more naturalistic way than either of the two previous adaptations, which may or may not be true to Frank Herbert's style, but definitely makes it easier to relate to the characters. However, due to its length, there are parts that drag a bit and cause me to doze off, so it isn't a completely gripping experience. I'll get into more details as we go along, but now let's get the opinion of someone who only began his journey to Dune this week. Dave.
Well, I'm going to say that, like the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings series, that the 2023 and 2024 cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's Dune are movies that I feel pressured to like more than I do. It's like, okay, guys, I know you think this is classic and all this, but like, I just got to speak from a subjective point of view. Having not read the books, it just likely boils down to the source material that I just don't find that interesting or compelling. I like it, but I'm not going gung-ho. This is not my religion. So I feel like the story of Dune inspired stories that I connect with much more. Stories that were much more distilled into a cogent narrative with more defined characters that were a bit more human, like the original Star Wars trilogy. But as it stands, I don't feel that much of a connection to the characters or the circumstances of either Dune Part 1 or Part 2. That's not to say I didn't appreciate it and I didn't like it, but we'll go into that more as we go on.
Justin Paul, or should we call you Justin Paul Muad'Dib? Let's get your opening remarks.
That's a good one, Howard.
I would say when I go into a film, there are three things that generally stand out to me as being the most important. I always, as someone that shoots my own cinematography, look at the visuals. Obviously, you need a story that's compelling. And then I'm looking at the editing and the acting. I think the acting is a fourth thing that's definitely, you know, key factor in how I view and my lasting impression of the content that I just watched. So going into the sequel to Dune, the first film I thought was beautiful in terms of the way it looked. I was a little offset with the editing of the first film, and the pacing felt a little sluggish. I think it was more of that for me in the second one, same kind of thing. And visually speaking, I actually enjoyed the first one better visually. I thought it was a little bit more unique than what we got out of this second part. So, overall, I thought it was okay.
Audrey, we all know your feelings about Dune 1984, and I know you really wanted us to review Dune Part 1, which scheduling just didn't permit in 2021. Was Dune Part 2 worth the wait?
Dune Part 2 was definitely worth the wait, and I can't say enough about waiting for Dune Part 3, which Villeneuve has already signaled he's on board for, and Part 3 is being written even as we speak. That said, I really felt, I agree with Justin, that the visuals and the pacing were better in Part 1 than Part 2. However, Part 2 has to jam a lot of material in just under 3 hours, and I do mean jam. That said, I think this is the best casting of any Dune version we've ever seen. Zendaya is perfect as Chani. In fact, I like the movie Chani far, far better than the book Chani. Book Chani's pretty boring. Book Chani is Paul's number one fan, who ultimately marries him, or actually doesn't, and becomes the royal broodmare. Movie Chani is great. Movie Chani is the voice of reason, who is not, in fact, a diehard believer. But she is a diehard Fedakin, and she is awesome in it. In the books, Princess Irulan is supposed to be basically a Russian grand chess master trapped in the body of an 18-year-old Nicole Kidman. However, I have to say, Florence Pugh is just perfect as Princess Irulan, as is the Emperor. Really, the casting could not have been better. And the Harkonnens, perfect in any way. I thought that for the movie version, Fade Rautha was an interesting direction to take that character in, but he's a psychopath. He's a cartoon villain. And in the books, he's kind of more of Paul through a mirror darkly. He's what Paul could have been, or for that matter, what Fade Rautha could have been if he hadn't been raised in the Harkonnen home. Because that's the big spoiler here. Surprise, Paul and Jessica are Harkonnens.
Can I ask Audrey something? All right, on the note of, how do you say his character, the Sting character?
Fade Rautha.
Because I haven't seen the 84, but I was always like drawn to that visual of Sting with the high hair. Which was the more accurate representation of that character?
Probably Sting. Like I said, there are some interesting directions that this movie went in. For example, in the books and also in the Lynch version, the Emperor, who did not have red hair, although he did in the books, the Emperor, Vladimir Harkonnen, Baron Harkonnen, and Fade Rautha all had red hair, as did Jessica, although hers was always described as dark bronze. Okay, or dark red. And Paul had barely any red in his hair, but it's an interesting motif throughout the books.
What gets very tricky for people like Justin and myself is that I think if you have an affinity to the source material and it's been a part of your life, there winds up being more of an emotional connection to when you're watching a film adaptation that's accurate and truthful. Same with, for me, Lord of the Rings. I like, but I don't love because I don't have the affinity of that connection to the source material. And that's what makes our respective reviews very unique, because we're coming to it from two different places in a way.
See, and I'm in between you guys, because I've never read the books. I have seen the movies, the miniseries, which I just am actually two-thirds of the way through, and I've read a lot of the comics that are written by Brian Herbert, Frank's son. And I recently watched Dune 1984 again, and the sci-fi miniseries. And of the three, despite the fact that Kyle MacLachlan was 25 when he played Paul, and Kyle Newman was 26, the same age as Timothée Chalamet was in the first part, and all of whom are at least 10 years older than Paul Atreides is supposed to be, Chalamet comes across as the youngest, Tom Holland playing Peter Parker. He's also the least physically imposing and the most immediately likable. So it definitely helps us to get behind his character and watch him grow into the leader known by no less than five names: Paul Atreides, Usul, Muad'Dib, Mahdi, and Lisan al-Ghaib. And we're not even getting into the Kwisatz Haderach because he's not there yet. Oddly, despite the more lengthy running time of the sci-fi version, there they only called him Paul and Muad'Dib. And that was a direct choice by the director to simplify things. Also, unlike his predecessors, actually believe his connection to Chani due to his chemistry with Zendaya, which, yes, I felt was lacking in either of the two previous versions.
Absolutely. Well, partially because in the Lynch version, the 1984 version, all the strong female characters apparently got lobotomies or something, because they're barely a presence on
screen. The Natalie Portman syndrome?
Oh, without question. Yeah. Sean Young is terrible in that.
Completely,
and you know,
awful.
We all know how good she was in Blade Runner, but she was just awful in Lynch's Dune. And again, Virginia Madsen largely functions as a narrator and has no other presence.
And, you know, she's dressed up as the princess and makes, you know, a screen appearance, but barely talks. In fact, she hardly talks at all throughout this, except as the narrator. So I got to be honest, I really love this. And while I love the original books, I'm happy to see the movie take a slightly different directorial approach. I'm fine with the way the characters are portrayed. I mean, to be honest, a lot of stuff that went down in the books would not play at all well with modern audiences. For example, Baron Harkonnen is an extremely predatory, sadistic gay rapist in the books. That's really not going to go over well with modern audiences. You can make a horror of a ruler without making him gay.
Was there any indication of that in the 84 adaptation?
A little bit. There's some slave boy in a diaper that Harkonnen floats over to, and they have, I think this is probably a Lynch invention, a heart plug. So basically it's a key over your heart, and Harkonnen literally pulls it out and he bleeds out immediately.
Right.
And since it hasn't been in either of the miniseries, it's probably one of Lynch's inventions, like the weirding module. So there are certain things that Lynch just invented because he wanted some style.
Justin's, you know, my creative partner on the feature film that we're working on, my co-producer and cinematographer, art director. And so when we're watching it, we're watching it through a very different kind of perspective at times. And sometimes he would lean over to me and he said, you know, that visual is like kind of peculiar. There was definitely points in this. Like, remember the floating, the way that they visualized certain things didn't seem to be at the top of like Villeneuve's prowess as a filmmaker. I mean, like there was definitely
the
some sequences.
Floating the anti-gravity suits, the way that they moved, they looked a little awkward, and it felt like maybe the touches weren't on that element of the film. I had more of a problem with other things, though. And I'll go back and I'll touch on another topic that we mentioned earlier. But my biggest problem with the film is that you have such a strong supporting cast. You have Josh Brolin and you have Rebecca Ferguson.
Right.
And you have Stellan Skarsgård. And I'm sitting here for 3 hours being forced to listen to the bulk majority of dialogue coming out of Timothy Chalamet's mouth and Zendaya, and they're fine. I like both of them. I think they're okay. But how do you have such a killer, dynamic, supporting cast taking a back seat and almost being dialed into, like, service cameos and have a movie that is not, you know, in some ways maddening? At least for me. I just felt like so much great talent was underutilized.
In part, it honestly is the story. And, yeah, I think Skarsgård did a fantastic job.
Yeah, he's probably my
Baron
favorite.
Baron Harkonnen. And Rebecca Ferguson is the last word in Lady Jessica. You could not have picked a better person.
Well, yeah, I thought as Jessica, she could almost be looked at as the stereotypical Jewish mother because she thinks her son is the Messiah. Of course, in her case, it's because she planned it that way. But here we see that her underlying goal is to get the Fremen to believe Paul is the Mahdi, even though Paul himself says that he's only there to learn their ways and get revenge on the Harkonnens for House Atreides. Audrey, do you think that Paul actually believes he is the Mahdi before he converts the Water of Life?
Actually, that's something I wanted to address. First off, this isn't exactly a plan by Lady Jessica to get the Fremen on her side. When the Atreides are given Arrakis as their fiefdom by the Emperor, this isn't a move they wanted to make, but they were forced into it. And they realized, all of them, Duke Leto, Lady Jessica, and Paul, that they were all going to have to form new alliances on this planet because they were leaving Caladan behind. That's it. They're not coming back. But having said that, the Bene Gesserit have been at work throughout the Imperium for centuries, for millennia, really. And they have planted their Missionaria Protectiva throughout all the known Imperium. So they have planted Bene Gesserit mothers and other members of the sisterhood, because it's not just the Reverend Mothers, it's the sisterhood as well. They have seeded cultures and they have taught the sisterhood, this is what you have to do in order to make yourself seem like the second coming or to gain a place of acceptance or safety to hide out. Their plans are literally measured in millennia.
We get much more of the culture of the Fremen than we have before, with Chani talking with her friends and a wider range of opinions about Paul and Jessica and whether or not they should be followed or killed. Admittedly, Sci-Fi's version gave us a Fremen orgy, which this one doesn't have, but the acting in this version is so much better.
Absolutely.
Due to the presence of major talent, whereas the Sci-Fi version was mostly nameless European actors. that you don't miss the sex and nudity.
Can I make a commentary on the acting itself?
Yeah.
Not having seen the other adaptations of the film, I did have some feelings about the performances in general. And I'm not sure if I really felt particularly strongly about any particular performance. I think that everything is good. Nothing is bad. But nothing is really that vibrant for me, other than maybe Skarsgård. And certainly Austin Butler tries to be vibrant. But, you know, Chalamet, I think, is a serviceable lead. But I'm seeing
him.
I'm seeing Wonka. I'm not feeling this character through him. He's fine. Zendaya, I'm seeing Zendaya. Like, I'm not forgetting that I'm looking at an actress playing a role. And Austin Butler, I think, is effective when he doesn't speak. The use of his face and his expressions. When he does speak, it's like Christian Bale is infused in his body.
Like Dark Knight growl.
Yeah.
And Christopher Walken seems like he's just reading his lines off of a cue card.
Well, there's a subtlety to the characters. Irulan and the Emperor are much more restrained. The thing I hated about the Lynch version of Dune is that everybody in it is chewing up the scenery.
They're opposites. You know, the thing is, I just feel like it's really challenging to take source material like this and to make it alive because it's a technical story. But I just feel like it wants just a little more humanity.
Well, that's just it.
The other thing that I think, and Dave and I discussed this also, there's this whole Game of Thrones vibe going on with the different houses. And
yes.
What I found, and Dave also found off-putting and slightly jarring, were characters like the Princess, Florence Pugh, and Timothée Chalamet. They almost would have been served better with British actors. Yes. And it would have fit, I think, the mold better. Like, there's a level in this movie that sort of bleeds aristocracy. And almost, I hate to say it, but I'm gonna, because it's evident in the director's comments, pretension. It's a pretentious movie. It's not trying to be anything other than that. It's telling you I'm smarter than you. And it's basically, you know, screaming it at the audience. It's the exact antithesis of what's been coming out of Marvel Studios lately. It's screaming at you, I know more than you, and I'm better than you.
Well, the funny part of that is, I love how this movie actually feels like a tour of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because MJ, Drax, Thanos, and Yelena Belova are transplanted into different bodies, and it's almost like the Fast and Furious series, how they mine the DCEU for actors like Gal Gadot and Jason Momoa.
Well, the other thing I'd like to point out is a major chunk of the second half of the book is the spice trance. It's so pivotal, and it was chopped down to nothing in this version, and it's really a pivotal point of the story. And by the way, you're wrong about Paul not becoming the Kwisatz Haderach. He became the Kwisatz Haderach when he took the waters of life and didn't die. That's the defining moment. That's also the defining moment when he looked into the golden path and saw the multitude of futures that he had in front of him. In one of those futures, he embraced the Baron Harkonnen and called him grandfather. And, quote-unquote, the vision sickened him. So there were many futures, but the golden path was the one that was best for humanity, not for him. That said, basically telling people, yep, we had a spice trance, and the whole, by the way, where Harkonnen's Did You Know just fell so flat for me because it is such a pivotal moment in the books.
Can anybody tell me when the visual from one, Timothée Chalamet has a vision in one with the golden armor? Is that something that's going to happen in part three?
Yes.
Okay. I thought that was a cool affect from the original.
Unless you see the words written out, it's kind of hard to tell the difference between Mahdi and Maudib verbally. Was that intentional on Frank Herbert's part?
Who knows? You know, there's a lot of made-up words in the books, and you kind of have to get into the whole world-building. The world-building is fantastic. I mean, that's right up there with Lord of the Rings in terms of world-building. But like I said, I love the visuals, the alienness of this movie. For example, when the Emperor comes to Dune in his shiny silver sphere, just the way the sands are hitting it and vaporizing on what is clearly an anti-gravity suspensor or shield or field or whatever you want to call it.
The soldiers rising from the sands is fantastic. I love that.
Just a lot of the visuals, because a lot of times you just look at this and go, oh my God.
Denny Boggs,
it's Schlock Rogers in the 21st and a half century.
He follows a similar sort of theme with the visuals that he had in Blade Runner 2049. And there's little nuances to the visuals that are really cool. But upon further inspection, if you go back and watch some of the stuff, it's really not that original. It's kind of been taken from films like Alien. And it's just been remanufactured to look like it's a little different. So I can't give too many points there. because it's just biomechanical. And the whole look of the Baron, his suit, the way that he's got the nodes in the back of his neck, it's really no different than what's been done before. It's just sort of been, like, off the grid for a while and sort of resurrected.
Yeah. Is there a bit of H.R. Giger influence in this version more so than any other version or the book
itself? I noticed that, too, especially in The House of Harkonnens. Yeah. I think we will see that more in Part 3 when we're introduced to the Tylaxu.
Well, the whole look of the Harkonnens is a ripoff of Prometheus.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, he didn't really do anything new there.
For the first time, the desert of Arrakis feels like a real place instead of a projection or a backdrop. And the sandworms are truly impressive and don't seem like models or poor CG constructs. This is the first time I got the scope of what it means to ride a sandworm. And that probably has to do with the decision to shoot this movie in IMAX. One thing that occurred to me as I was watching it was, how do the Fremen dismount once they get to where they want to go?
That I can
and
tell
Villeneuve
you.
Actually posted a video saying that even though it's not shown, basically they ride the worm to exhaustion and jump off once the worm stops moving.
Well, actually, there's two ways to do it. The first way is what you described, which is ride the worm to exhaustion and then just hop off when it's tired and annoyed. In the books, however, you do have the rider, the person who jumps on the worm first and uses the maker hooks, that's what they're called, to turn the worm and basically use it to guide the worm and prevent it from going underneath the surface, and then the other Fremen jump on. That said, I really, really love the way the movie depicts the sandworm. You know, riding it is not like hopping across town bus like in the sci-fi version or the Lynch version, where, you know, Kyle MacLellan is sitting there with what's clearly a fan blowing his over hairsprayed hair. I was like, okay, you can believe that this is the thing that rules Arrakis, that rules Dune, why they worship it as a god. It's huge, it's powerful, it's potentially immortal, and it's extremely dangerous. It's like taking a meteor to get to your next destination. I love the visuals for the worm. The best yet, honestly.
The Harkonnens, while ruthlessly evil, don't go quite as over the top as they were shown in 1984. Baron Harkonnen doesn't have the dripping pustules on his skin. Dave Bautista's Beast Raban is more threatening and less stupid than the original. And Fade Rautha, played by Oscar winner Austin Butler, is less handsome, much more terrifying, and also more subtle than Sting.
He was not an Oscar winner. He was an Oscar nominee. Golden Globe winner.
Okay.
Brendan Fraser won for
Actor. For The Whale. I apologize, but you're right. On the other hand, Sting is a singer first and an actor second compared to Butler, so one should expect a better performance.
Well, also there's the direction from the director, which is chew up the scenery and everybody declaim loudly like you were in the third grade class play.
True, that is not most of what Lynch's direction was, is everybody screams their lines.
Yeah. Stand in this spot and scream. The lighting's perfect here. Go for it.
David Lynch's Dune featured this invention, the weirding modules, which converted sound into destructive energy. Because this version is more faithful to the book, the fighting here is done with knives and more conventional guns. Justin, as someone whose online name is Design Weapons, what did you think of the weapons design in this movie?
The guns in particular were fantastic and powerful. The laser cannons, he did some things that are different from like things that you've seen in other science fiction films of late. I feel like something could have been done with the sword play, although if it's trying to stay original to the source material, maybe not. However, I think like in films like Rebel Moon, Zack Snyder was able to grab and sort of do a lightsaber that wasn't a lightsaber. Pretty something new, something that looks futuristic. This movie is, part of it looks futuristic, part of it looks antiquated. I understand that's kind of the look they were going for, but I'm not really sold on it being futuristic as a whole. Like, you know, the environments, the desert, I get it. They want to do it off of a volume. They want to make it look as real as possible. It just doesn't look alien to me. You know,
well,
it doesn't.
Dune is first and foremost space opera. It's a really intelligent, political, and ecological commentary set in a science fiction series. But really, it's space opera. It's not hard science fiction. If it was, we'd have to ask, where's all the energy to power all this stuff coming from? Because nobody knows. Never mentioned once.
There was a scene in the 2000 miniseries where Paul asks Shani if she could love someone so much that she could let him go. That exchange is not in this movie, but it probably should have been because it would have helped understand something that happens late in the film. But because it is omitted, it gives Zendaya the chance to do some really impressive nonverbal acting.
Oh, yeah. She was great. I mean, honestly, I love the movie version so much better than the book version. I did not like the book version of Chani at all. So
I just think she looked angry all the time, like an ex-girlfriend that's constantly angry at me. Yeah, it was kind of giving me anxiety, honestly.
Well, the other thing, the thing that I missed the most, no Aaliyah, what happened here?
Right, exactly. That was what I was going to point out. In Lynch's version, Paul apparently spent several years among the Fremen before leading his attack on the Harkonnens, which
that's
is probably believable considering all he had to learn and the number of Fremen that needed to be gathered and trained. Here, the time that Paul and Jessica spend in the desert has to be less than 9 months because Jessica never gives birth to Aaliyah, and even though she is sentient and telepathically speaks with her mother, she's only depicted as a partially developed fetus, except in Paul's vision where she's seen as an adult played by Anya Taylor-Joy. Lynch's version had Aaliyah grow at an accelerated rate. Audrey, very briefly, is there anything in the book to suggest that the Water of Life caused her to spend an excessive time gestating?
No, and that's the thing, is she was considered preborn, okay? The spice trance actually is what creates the Reverend Mother, okay? And the Reverend Mothers acquire all the memories of their female ancestors and, coincidentally, also in the spice trance, they get the memories of the Reverend Mother, who's dying in this case, and transferring sort of her powers. It's a little woo, but again, that's how it works in the books. However, Jessica would not have been forced to take the Waters of Life and go into the spice trance had they known that she was pregnant, because one of the things the Bene Gesserit strive not to do is create preborn children. Aaliyah inherited all of her female ancestors' memories as an unborn infant, as a fetus. She became fully aware, fully adult, before she was ever born.
Right. We got to start wrapping things up so that Ménage à Trois will get on the air within the next couple of minutes. Does this movie deserve to be the hit that it seems to be shaping up to? Let's get everyone's final comments and what this movie is worth on the famous Destiny $0 to $9.50 rating scale. We'll start with Audrey.
Okay. I felt it was rushed and a lot of things really got chopped out or given very short shrift that are pivotal to the story. That said, the cast is stellar, the acting is stellar, and I love the visuals. I'm giving it 885 out of 950.
Dave?
Some of the visuals are fantastic. Hans Zimmer's score is powerful, but I'm left feeling a little cold and a little disinterested, honestly. I liked it, but I didn't love it. $7 because Audrey would be mad at me if I gave it any less.
You're right.
Paul?
Mysticism, imperialism, colonialism, and all the above, I think it's been done better in movies like Star Wars. And I just don't see the epicness that I'm seeing with the reviews. I don't feel moved by it in any way. I think it looks great. I think it's cool and it's weird. I also think that it's something that would probably take me a great amount of effort to watch again and get excited for. So I'm going to give it a 6.
Before I give my comments, I'll let you know that absentee reviewer Timothy Gillespie said that he, quote, enjoyed every second of it and gave the movie $9.25. Midnight here at WUSB Stony Brook. We are wrapping up Destiny's review of Dune Part 2. As I said, Ménage à Trois coming up in just a couple minutes, so please stay tuned. Having watched this story 3 times in 3 different versions in the past few weeks, I have to say that, by and large, this is the superior adaptation. It has the budget to pull off the scope of the unenviable task of making the world look believable. It takes the time to go into details and develop the characters, although sometimes a bit too much time, and the actors deliver their lines in ways that make the characters more realistic and relatable. However, as I said earlier, it did feel like it ran long, and it did drag a bit in the middle with some of the rating sequences. Plus, for all of the time Paul and Chani spent together, it would have been decent of him to give her some hint of his ultimate plan, as he did in the TV version, as a sign of respect for her feelings. And quite honestly, I think the TV version did a better job in making Princess Irulan a better character. So while not perfect, this is a very good movie, and I give Dune Part 2 $8.50 out of $9.50. Before we return to our homeworlds, I'll remind you that next week I'll celebrate my 40th anniversary with The Voice of Science Fiction by bringing you part one of the Icon Writers Reunion featuring Keith R.A. DeCandido, Patrick Thomas, Drew Hendrickson, and Roy Morrison, recorded at last year's Icon in the Park event. We'll conclude the panel on March 22nd and also bring you a new letter to Patrick Thomas's Dear Cthulhu. And in 3 weeks, the Destiny's Film Review team will assemble live again, hopefully at 11:15 p.m., to discuss Ghostbusters Frozen Empire in the first of our spring radiothon specials. As Destiny's 40s continue, listen for more poems by Christina M. Rao, a memorial for Tracy Torme, Destiny's radio theater performances of Battle for the Planet of the Apes, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Gremlins, and The Last Starfighter. Interviews with Robin Esterhammer, Devo Spice, Robin Curtis, Athena Kamen, Jim Shooter, Zia Adams, Sam J. Jones, and Lance Hendrickson. Mark Gunn at the Icon 31 Cabaret. Panels and concerts from Icon, Eternal Con, L-Icon and L-I Who, and Destiny's 41st Anniversary Special. To offer your comments about our program or to request copies of this or any previous broadcasts, you can write to Destiny's, care of WUSB Radio, Second Floor West Side Dining, Stony Brook University, Stony Brook, New York, 11794. You can also send email to destinysvoice@AOL.com. That's destinysvoice@AOL.com, or tweet us at Destinies. Or you can call us at 631-632-6901. That's 631-632-6901 right after tonight's show. Destinies is produced by members and friends of the Science Fiction Forum in association with WUSB Stony Brook. The forum is located in rooms LO608 and LO609 in the Stony Brook Student Union. For information about forum activities, including next Saturday's 55th anniversary banquet, log on to sf4m.org. That's sf4m.org. To hear archived Destiny shows, including our December 18th, 1984 episode, featuring a review of David Lynch's Dune, visit www.captfilonline.com. That's CaptphilOnline.com. While you're online, learn about the films of Dave Campfield at DaveCampfield.com. That's DaveCampfield.com. And view the work of Justin Paul at Instagram.com/designweapons. That's Instagram.com/DesignWeapons. Listen for 3 hours of encore broadcasts and music featuring chapters of Evelyn Husband's High Calling on the Destiny's Archives Mini Marathon, Thursday, March 14th from 3 to 6 a.m. here on WUSB. Tonight's show is dedicated to the memory of Arthur Douglas Gillespie, the father of our own Timothy Gillespie, who died on March 7th at the age of 79 after a battle with cancer. Arthur was an avid model railroader with a collection that ranged from pre-war to modern-age trains. Tim said that his father introduced him to a lot of comedy and sci-fi movies, and as a big Star Trek fan, would take his kids to see any of the movies when they came out. Our deepest condolences go to Tim and his family on the loss of his father. Until next Friday at 11:30 p.m. when we'll take you to Icon in the Park for part one of the Icon Writers' Reunion. This is Howard Margolin.
This is Audrey Detmering.
Justin Paul.
Dave Campfield.
Reminding you to stay tuned for Menage a Trois coming up next, saying long live the fighters and wishing you the best of all possible destinies.